robe, where she had her stockings, she kept a small diary and some important letters, but I didn't touch them. I knew the password for her laptop, assuming she hadn't changed it, but didn't even open it. None of this had anything to do with me anymore. I washed the cup I'd drunk tea in, dried it with a cloth, put it back on the shelf, and turned off the lights. I went over to the window and gazed at the falling rain for a while. The orangish Tokyo Tower loomed up faintly in the distance. Then I dropped the key in the mailbox and drove back to Odawara. The trip was only an hour and a half, but it felt like I'd taken a day trip to a far-off foreign land. The next day I called my agent. "I'm back in Tokyo," I told him, "and I'm really sorry, but I don't plan to do any more portrait painting."
"You're never going to do any more portraits? Is that what you're telling me?"
"Most likely," I said. He didn't say much. No complaints, nothing in the way of advice. He knew that once I said something, I didn't back down.
"If you ever find yourself wanting to do this work again, call me anytime," he said at the end. "I'd welcome it."
"Thank you," I said.
"Maybe it isn't my place to say this, but how are you planning to make a living?"
"I haven't decided," I admitted. "I'm by myself, so I don't need much to live on, and I've got a bit of savings."
"Will you still paint?"
"Probably. There isn't much else I know how to do."
"I hope it works out."
"Thanks," I said once more, and tagged on a question that had just occurred to me. "Is there anything I should make sure to keep in mind?"
"Something you should make sure to keep in mind?
In other words, how should I put it? Any advice from a pro?"
He thought it over. "You're the type of guy who takes longer than other people to be convinced of anything. But long term, I think time is on your side."
Like the title of an old Rolling Stones song.
"One other thing, I think you really have a special talent for portraiture. An intuitive ability to get straight to the heart of the subject. Other people can't do that. Not using that talent would be a real shame."
"But right now, painting portraits isn't what I want to do."
"I get that. But someday that ability will help you again. I hope it works out."
"Hope it works out," I thought. "Good if time is on your side." On the first day I visited the house in Odawara, Masahiko Amada, the son of the owner, drove me there in his Volvo. "If you like it, you can move in today," he said. We took the Odawara Atsugi Road almost to the end, and, when we exited, headed toward the mountains along a narrow, paved farm road. On either side, there were fields, rows of hothouses for growing vegetables, and the occasional grove of plum trees. We saw hardly any houses, and not a single traffic signal. Finally, we drove up a steep, winding slope in low gear for a long time, until we came to the end and arrived at the entrance to the house. There were two stately pillars at the entrance, but no gate, and no wall either. It seemed the owner had planned to add a gate and wall, but thought better of it. Maybe halfway through he'd realized there was no need. On one of the pillars was a magnificent nameplate with Amada on it, almost like some business sign. The house beyond was a small Western-style cottage with a faded brick chimney sticking out of the flat roof. It was a one-story house, but the roof was unexpectedly high. In my imagination, I'd been taking it for granted that a famous painter of Japanese-style paintings would live in an old Japanese-style dwelling. We parked in a spacious covered driveway by the front door, and when we opened the car doors, some screeching black birds, jays, I imagine, flew off from a nearby tree branch into the sky. They seemed none too happy about us intruding on their space. The house was pretty, surrounded by woods with a variety of trees, with only the west side of the house open to a broad view of the valley.
"What do you think?"
Not much here, is there?
I stood there, gazing around me. He was right. There wasn't much there. I was impressed that his father had built a house in such isolated surroundings. He really must have wanted nothing to do with other people.
Did you grow up here? I asked.
No, I've never lived here very long. Just came to stay over occasionally, or visited on summer holidays when we were escaping the heat. I had school and grew up in our house in Mejiro with my mother. When my father wasn't working, he'd come to Tokyo and live with us, then come back here and work by himself. I went out on my own, then 10 years ago my mother died, and ever since he's been living here by himself, like someone who's forsaken the world.
A middle-aged woman who lived nearby had been watching the house, and she came over to explain some things I needed to know, how the kitchen operated, how to order more propane and kerosene, where various items were kept, which days the trash was picked up, and where to put it. The artist seemed to have led a very simple, solitary existence, with very little equipment or appliances, so there wasn't much for a lecture. If there's anything else you need to know, just give me a call, the woman said, though I actually never called her, not even once.
I'm very happy someone will be living here now, she said. Empty houses get dilapidated, and they're unsafe. And when they know no one's at home, the wild boar and monkeys get into the yard.
You do get the occasional wild boar or monkey around here, Masahiko said.
Be very careful about the wild boars, the woman explained. You see a lot of them in the spring around here when they root for bamboo shoots. Female boars with young are always jumpy and dangerous, and you need to watch out for hornets, too. There have been people who've been stung and died. The hornets build nests in the plum groves.
The central feature of the house was a fairly large living room with an open hearth fireplace. On the southwest side of the living room was a spacious roofed-in terrace, and on the north side was a square studio. The studio was where the master had done his painting. On the east side of the living room was a compact kitchen with dining area and a bathroom, then a comfortable master bedroom and a slightly smaller guest bedroom. There was a writing desk in the guest bedroom. Amada seemed to enjoy reading, as the bookshelves were stuffed with old books. He seemed to have used this room as his study. For an older house, it was fairly neat and clean, and comfortable-looking, though strangely enough, or perhaps not so strangely, there was not a single painting hanging on the walls. Every wall was completely bare. As Masahiko had said, the place had most everything I'd need, furniture, electric appliances, plates and dishes, and bedding. You don't need to bring anything, he'd told me, and he was right. There was plenty of firewood for the fireplace stacked up under the eaves of the shed. There was no TV in the house. Masahiko's father, I was told, hated TV, though there was a wonderful stereo set in the living room. The speakers were huge Tannoy autographs, the separate amplifier an original vacuum tube Marantz, and he had an extensive collection of vinyl records. At first glance, there seemed to be a lot of boxed sets of opera.
There's no CD player here, Masahiko told me. He's the sort of person who hates new devices. He only trusts things from the past. Naturally, there's not a trace of anything to do with the internet. If you need to use it, the only choice is to use the internet cafe in town.
I don't have any real need for the internet, I told him.
If you want to know what's going on in the world, then the only choice is to listen to the news on the transistor radio on the shelf in the kitchen. Since we're in the mountains, the signal isn't great, but you can at least pick up the NHK station in Shizuoka. Better than nothing, I suppose.
I'm not that interested in what's going on in the world.
That's fine. Sounds like you and my father would get along fine.
Is your father a fan of opera? I asked.
Yes, he paints Japanese paintings, but always liked to listen to opera while he painted. He went to the opera house a lot when he was a student in Vienna. Do you listen to opera?
A little.
I'm not into it at all,
Way too long and boring for me. There are a lot of records, so feel free to listen to them as much as you'd like. My father has no need of them anymore, and I know he'd be happy if you listened to them.
No need of them?
His dementia's getting bad. Right now he doesn't know the difference between an opera and a frying pan.
Vienna, you said? Did he study Japanese painting in Vienna?
Nobody's that eccentric. To go all the way to Vienna to study Japanese painting. My father originally worked on Western painting. That's why he went to study in Vienna. At the time, he did very cutting-edge modern oil paintings. But after he came back to Japan, he suddenly switched styles and began painting Japanese style. Not totally unheard of, I suppose. Going abroad awakens your own ethnic identity or something.
And he was very successful at it.
Amada made a small shrug. According to the public, he was. But from a child's perspective, he was just a grouchy old man. All he thought about was painting, and did exactly as he pleased. No trace of that now, though.
How old is he?
92. When he was young, he was apparently pretty wild. I never heard the details.
I thanked him. Thank you for everything. I'm really grateful. This really helps me out.
You like it here?
Yes, I'm really happy you're letting me stay.
I'm glad, though I'm hoping you and Yuzu can get back together again.
I didn't respond.
Masahiko himself wasn't married. I'd heard a rumor he was bisexual, though I didn't know if it was true or not. We'd known each other for a long time, but had never spoken about it.
Are you going to keep doing portraits? Amada asked as we were leaving.
I explained how I'd made a clean break with portrait painting.
Then how are you going to make a living? Amada asked, the same thing my agent had wanted to know.
I'll cut back on expenses and get by on my savings for a while, I replied, echoing my first answer. I also wanted to try painting whatever I wanted, something I hadn't been able to do for ages.
Sounds good, Amada said. Do what you like for a while.
But would you consider teaching art part-time too? There's this Arts and Culture Center near Odawara Station, and they have painting classes. Most of them are for children, but they have some community art classes for adults set up as well. They teach sketching and watercolor, but not oil painting. The man who runs the school knows my father. He's not really in it for the money. And he needs a teacher. I'm sure he'd be overjoyed if you'd help out. It doesn't pay much, but you could make a little extra to live on. You'd only need to teach twice a week, and it shouldn't be too much trouble.
But I've never taught painting. I don't know much about watercolors.
It's simple, he said. You're not training professionals, you just teach the basics. You'll pick it up in a day. Teaching children should be good for you, too. And if you're going to live up here all by yourself, you have to get down off the mountain a couple of times a week and be with other people, even if you don't want to, or else you'll go a little stir-crazy. Don't want you ending up like The Shining.
Masahiko screwed up his face like Jack Nicholson. He's always been good at impressions. I laughed. I'll give it a try. Whether I'll do a good job or not, I don't know.
I'll get in touch with him and let him know, he said.
Then Masahiko drove me to the used Toyota dealership next to the highway, where I paid cash for the Corolla station wagon. My life alone on a mountaintop in Odawara began that day. I'd been on the move for nearly 2 months, but now I'd take up a sedentary life. It was quite a switch. Starting the following week, I began teaching art classes on Wednesdays and Fridays at the Arts and Culture Center near Odawara Station. There was a perfunctory interview beforehand, but Masahiko's introduction meant that I was as good as hired already. I was to teach two classes for adults plus one for children on Fridays. I quickly got used to teaching the kids. I enjoyed seeing the paintings they did, and as Masahiko said, it was a good stimulus for me as well. I quickly got to be friends with the children. All I did was go around the room, check on the paintings they did, give them a few words of technical advice, find good points about their paintings, and praise and encourage them. My approach was to have them paint the same subject matter several times, to instill in them the idea that the same object could appear quite different if viewed from a different angle. Just as people had many facets, so too did objects. The kids immediately picked up on how fascinating this could be. Teaching adults was a bit more of a challenge. The students were either elderly retirees or housewives whose children were grown and in school and had time on their hands. As you might imagine, they weren't as adaptable as the kids, and when I pointed out something, they didn't easily accept my suggestions. A few of them, though, were willing to learn, and there were a couple who did some pretty appealing paintings. Whenever they asked, I gave them helpful pointers, but for the most part, I let them paint however they liked. I confined myself to praising them whenever I found something nice about what they'd done. That seemed to please them. I figured it was enough for them to simply enjoy painting. And I started sleeping with two housewives, both of whom attended the art classes and received my so-called instruction. Both my students, in other words, and incidentally, both fairly decent painters. It's hard for me to tell whether that was something permissible for a teacher, even a casual teacher like me with no proper license. I basically think mutually consenting adults having sex isn't a problem, though certainly society might frown at this kind of relationship. I'm not trying to excuse my actions, but at the time, I really didn't have the mental wherewithal to decide whether I was right or wrong. I was desperately clinging to a scrap of wood that had been swept away. In pitch-black darkness, not a single star or the moon visible in the sky. As long as I clung to that piece of wood, I wouldn't drown, but I had no clue where I was, where I was heading. It was a couple of months after I'd moved there that I discovered Tomohiko Amada's painting, Killing Commendatore. I couldn't know it at the time, but that one painting changed my world forever. Chapter 4. From a distance, most things look beautiful. One sunny morning near the end of May, I carried all my painting materials into the studio Mr. Amada had been using, and for the first time in what seemed like forever, stood before a brand new canvas. Nothing of the master's painting materials was left in the studio. I assumed that Masahiko had packed them all away somewhere. The studio was a large square room 16 feet on a side with a wood floor and white walls. The floor was bare wood with not a single rug. There was a large open window on the north side with simple white curtains. The window on the east side was smaller with no curtains. As elsewhere in the house, there was nothing hanging on the walls. In one corner of the room was a large porcelain sink for washing away paint. The sink must have been in long use, for its surface was dyed with a mix of different colors. Next to the sink was an old-fashioned kerosene stove, and there was a large ceiling fan, a work table, and a round wooden stool. A compact stereo set was on a built-in shelf, so he could listen to opera while painting. The wind blowing in the open window carried with it the fresh fragrance of trees. This was, without doubt, a space for an artist to focus on his work. Everything you might need was here, and not one thing extra. Now that I had this environment to work in, the feeling of wanting to paint something grew stronger. Like a quiet ache, and there were no limits on the amount of time I could spend for myself. No need any longer to paint things I didn't want to in order to earn a living. No more obligation to prepare dinner for my wife when she came home. Not that I minded making dinner, though that didn't change the fact that it was an obligation. And it wasn't just preparing meals.
I had the right to stop eating altogether and starve if I felt like it. I was utterly free to do exactly what I wanted without worrying about anybody else. In the end, though, I couldn't paint a thing. No matter how long I stood in front of the canvas and stared at that white, blank space, not a single idea of what to paint came to me. I had no clue where to begin, how to start. Like a novelist who has lost words or a musician who has lost his instrument, I stood there in that bare, square studio at a complete loss. I'd never felt that way before, not ever. Once I faced a canvas, my mind would immediately leave the horizon of the everyday, and something would well up in my imagination. Sometimes it would be a productive image, at other times a useless illusion, but still, something would always come to me. From there I'd latch on to it, transfer it to the canvas and continue to develop it, letting my intuition lead the way. If I did it that way, the work completed itself. But now, I couldn't see anything that would provide the initial spark. You can have all the desire and ache inside you want, but what you really need is a concrete starting point. I would get up early in the morning. I generally always wake before 6, brew coffee in the kitchen, and then, mug in hand, pad off to the studio and sit on the stool in front of the canvas and focus my feelings. Listen closely to the echoes in my heart, trying to grasp the image of something that had to be there. But this always ended in a fruitless retreat. I'd try concentrating for a while, then plunk down on the studio floor, lean back against the wall, and listen to a Puccini opera. I'm not sure why, but all I seemed to listen to then was Puccini. Turandot, La Bohème. I'd sit there, staring at the languidly rotating ceiling fan, waiting for an idea or motif to come to me. But nothing ever came. Just the early summer sun that rose sluggishly in the sky. What was the problem? Maybe it's because I'd spent so many years doing portraits for a living. Maybe that diminished any natural intuition I had, like sand slowly washed away by the tide. Somehow the flow of my life had gone off in the wrong direction. I needed time, I thought. I had to be patient. Make time be on my side. Do that, and I was sure to seize the right flow. That channel would surely come back to me. Truthfully, though, I wasn't sure it ever would. It was during this period, too, that I slept with the 2 married women. I think I was looking for some kind of inner breakthrough. Come what may, I wanted to break out of the rut I was in, and the only way for me to do so was to jolt my psyche, give it a prod, it didn't matter what kind. Plus, I'd started to tire of being alone, and it had been a long time since I'd slept with a woman. It occurs to me now that my days back then were pretty strange. I'd wake up early, go into that small, square, white-walled studio, have no ideas for what to paint as I stared at the blank canvas, then flop down on the floor and listen to Puccini. When it came to the realm of creativity, I was basically facing a pure nothingness. When Claude Debussy had writer's block while composing an opera, he wrote, "Day after day I produce rien, nothingness." That summer was the same for me. Day after day I took part in producing nothingness. Perhaps I was quite used to facing nothingness day after day, though I wouldn't go so far as to say we were intimate. About twice a week in the afternoon, the second of the married women would drive to my place in her red mini. We'd go straight to bed and make love. In the early afternoon, we'd devour each other's flesh. What this produced was, of course, not nothingness,
No doubt about it, actual flesh and blood bodies were involved, bodies you could actually touch with your hands, every inch, even run your lips over them. In this way, as if I'd flipped a switch on my consciousness, I began moving between an ambiguous, vague rien and a vivid, living reality. The woman said her husband hadn't made love to her in nearly 2 years. He was 10 years older than she was and busy with work, never returning home until late at night. She tried many ways of enticing him, but nothing seemed to rouse his interest.
"I wonder why. I mean, you have such a lovely body," I said.
She gave a small shrug. "We've been married over 15 years and have 2 kids. I guess I'm no longer as fresh as I used to be."
"You seem plenty fresh to me."
"Thanks. Though that makes it sound like I'm being recycled or something."
"Like recycling resources?"
"Exactly."
"It's a very precious resource, though," I said. "Contributes to society, too." She giggled.
"As long as you sort everything correctly."
A little while later, we eagerly set out to sort out resources once more. Truthfully, I wasn't all that drawn to her as a person at first. In that sense, there was a different tone about our relationship than with the women I'd dated. She and I had almost nothing in common to talk about. There was hardly anything about our present lives or our personal histories until then that overlapped. I'm not generally a talkative person, so when we were together, she did most of the talking. She'd tell me personal things and I'd make the appropriate responses, giving my feedback, I guess you'd call it, though it was hardly a real conversation. This was a first for me. With other women, I'd always been attracted to their personalities. Physical relationships came later, something that accompanied the initial appeal. That was the usual pattern. But not with her. With her, the physical came first. Not that I'm complaining. When I was with her, I could enjoy the act in a pure, unfettered way. And I think she could too. She came many times as we made love, and I came many times too. She told me this was the first time since she got married that she'd slept with another man. I had no reason to doubt her, and for me too, this was the first time I'd slept with another woman since I got married. No, actually, there was one exception, when I shared a bed with another woman. Not that it was something I was looking for. I'll get into that later on. "But my friends the same age, all of them are married, but most of them are having affairs," she said. "They talk about it a lot." "Recycling," I said.
"I never imagined I'd join them."
I gazed up at the ceiling and thought about Yuzu. Was she off somewhere? In bed with somebody? After the woman left, I felt at loose ends. The bed still showed the hollows where she had lain. I didn't feel like doing anything, so I lay out on a lounge chair on the terrace and killed time reading a book. All the books on Mr. Amada's bookshelf were old, among them a few unusual novels that would be hard to get hold of these days. Works that in the past had been pretty popular, but had been forgotten, read by no one. I enjoyed reading this kind of out-of-date novel. Doing so let me share, with this old man I'd never met, the feeling of being left behind by time. As the sun set, I opened a bottle of wine. Drinking wine was my one and only luxury at the time, though of course this was inexpensive wine, and listened to some old LPs. The record collection was comprised entirely of classical music, the majority of which was opera and chamber music. All of them looked like they'd been lovingly cared for, without a single scratch. During the day I listened to opera, while at night I favored Beethoven and Schubert's string quartets. Having a relationship with that older married woman, being able to hold a real live woman in my arms regularly, brought me a certain level of calm.
The soft touch of a mature woman's skin eased the pent-up emotions I'd had. At the very least, while I made love to her, I was able to shelve the doubts and problems I'd been carrying around. Yet I still wasn't able to come up with an idea of what to paint. Occasionally, in bed, I'd do a pencil sketch of her in the nude. Most of these were pornographic. Pictures of my cock inside her, or her sucking me off. The sketches made her blush, but she enjoyed looking at them. I imagined that if these had been photos, most women wouldn't have liked them, and would even have been disgusted with the man who made them, and on their guard. But I found that with rough sketches, if they were done well, women were actually happy to see them, because they had the warmth of life in them, or at least they didn't have a mechanical coldness. But still, no matter how well I managed these sketches, not even a fragment of an image of what I really wanted to paint came to me. The kind of paintings I did as a student, so-called abstracts, no longer appealed to me. My heart wasn't drawn to them anymore. Looking back on it now, I see that what I'd been wrapped up in back then was nothing more than the pursuit of form. Back when I was young, I was completely drawn to the beauty of form and to balance. Nothing wrong with that. But in my case, I didn't reach the soulful depth that should lie beyond. Now I see it very clearly, but at the time all I could grasp was the appeal of shape at a superficial level. Nothing really moved me. My paintings were smart, but nothing more. And now I was 36. 40 was just around the corner. I felt that by the time I turned 40, I'd have to secure my own unique artistic world. 40 was a sort of watershed for people. Once you get past that age, you can't keep going on as you were before. I still had 4 years to go, but I knew that those 4 years might flash by in an instant. Painting portraits for a living had taken me on a wide detour. Somehow, I had to get time on my side once again. While I lived in that house in the mountains, I found myself wanting to know more about Tomohiko Amada. I'd never been interested in Japanese-style painting, and though I'd heard the name Tomohiko Amada, and he happened to be my friend's father, I had no idea what kind of person he was, or what kind of paintings he did. He might be a heavyweight in the world of Japanese painting, but he had totally stayed out of the limelight, turning his back on his worldly renown, and alone, quietly, or one might say stubbornly, focused on creating his art. This was about the extent of what I knew about him. But as I listened to his record collection on the stereo he'd left behind, borrowed his books, slept in his bed, made meals every day in his kitchen, and used his studio, I gradually became more interested in Tomohiko Amada as a person. Something close to curiosity, you could say. The path he'd taken aroused my interest. The way he'd been focused on modernist painting, traveled all the way to Vienna to study, then, after returning to Japan, made a sudden return to Japanese-style painting. I didn't know the details, but in general you would think that it couldn't have been very easy for someone who'd done Western painting for so long to shift over to Japanese-style painting. You'd need to decide to abandon all the techniques you'd spent so much time and effort mastering and begin again from zero. Despite this, Tomohiko Amada had chosen that arduous path. There must have been a compelling reason. One day before my art class, I went to the Odawara City Library to search out collections of Tomohiko Amada's artwork. Probably because he was an artist living in the area, the library had 3 beautiful volumes of his work. One of them included some of the Western paintings he'd done in his 20s as reference material. What surprised me was that the series of Western-style paintings he'd done as a young man reminded me somewhat of the abstract paintings I'd done myself in the past. The style wasn't specifically the same. In the pre-war period, he'd been heavily influenced by Cubism, yet his stance of greedily pursuing form in no small way had something in common with my own approach. As you might expect from someone who went on to become a first-class artist, his paintings also had much more depth and persuasive power than mine. Technically, too, there were things about them that were simply astounding. I imagine they must have been highly acclaimed at the time. Still, there was something missing. I sat there in the reading room at the library and carefully examined his works for a long time. So what was it that was lacking from his work? I couldn't pinpoint it. But if I had to give an opinion, I'd say they were paintings that weren't really necessary. The kind of paintings that, if they disappeared somewhere forever, wouldn't put anybody out. A cruel way of putting it, perhaps, but it's the truth. From the present perspective, some 70 years on, I could see that quite well. I turned the pages and followed along in chronological order to see how he shifted gears to become a painter of Japanese-style art. In his early period, these works were still a bit awkward, imitating the methods of previous artists, but then gradually and undeniably, he discovered his own unique style. I could see how it progressed. A bit of trial and error at times, but no hesitation. After he took up painting Japanese-style art, his works all had something unique that only he could paint, and he himself was well aware of this. He always strode confidently toward the core of that special something. No more did you get the impression, as with his Western paintings, of something missing. It was less a shift and more akin to a conversation. Like most artists of Japanese-style paintings, at first Tomohiko Amada painted realistic scenery and flowers, but eventually, and there must have been some motive for this, he began painting scenes from ancient Japan. Some were themes from the Heian and Kamakura periods, but what he was most fond of was the Asuka period at the beginning of the 7th century, specifically the period when Prince Shotoku Taishi, the legendary regent, was alive. On his canvases, he boldly, minutely, reproduced the scenery, historical events, and lives of the people of that period. Naturally, he had never witnessed those scenes in reality with his own eyes, but with his inner eye, he saw them clearly and vividly. Why he chose the Asuka period, I have no idea, but that became his own special period, done in an inimitable style. And with the passage of time, his technique in painting Japanese-style paintings became even more refined. If you pay close attention, you can see that from a certain point on, he painted exactly what he wanted to paint. From then on, his brush seemed to freely leap across the canvas. The wonderful part about his paintings was the use of blank space. Paradoxically, the best part was what was not depicted. By not painting certain things, he clearly accentuated what he did want to paint. This is undoubtedly one of the areas that Japanese painting excels at. At least, I'd never seen such bold use of blank space in any Western paintings. Seeing this, I could somehow understand why Tomohiko Amada converted to painting Japanese art. But what I didn't understand was exactly when and how he made that daring conversion and put it into practice. According to his brief biography at the end of the book, he was born in the mountainous Aso district in Kumamoto. His father was a great landowner, an influential local figure, and his family was quite affluent. He was always artistically talented and distinguished himself while still quite young. He graduated from the Tokyo Fine Arts School, later Tokyo University of the Arts, and with great expectations for his career, studied abroad in Vienna from the end of 1936 to 1939. At the beginning of 1939, before World War II began, he boarded a passenger ship from Bremen and returned to Japan. Hitler was in power during this time. Austria was annexed by Germany, the so-called Anschluss taking place in March 1938, and the young Tomohiko Amada was right there in Vienna in the midst of this turbulent period. He must have witnessed a number of historical events at that time. So what happened to him then? I read through a long essay in one of the collections titled Theory of Tomohiko Amada, only to find that almost nothing was known about his time in Vienna. The essay went into great detail about his career as a painter of Japanese-style paintings after he returned to Japan, yet there was only vague, baseless speculation about the motives and details of the conversion he must have experienced during his time in Vienna. What he had done in Vienna and what had led him to his dramatic conversion remained a mystery. Tomohiko Amada returned to Japan in February 1939 and settled into a rented house in Sendagi in Tokyo. By this point, he had completely abandoned Western painting. But he still received an allowance every month from his family, so he wanted for nothing. His mother, in particular, doted on her son. During this period, he was apparently studying Japanese-style painting on his own. A number of times he tried to have established painters take him under their wing, but it never worked out. Tomohiko was, from the first, not exactly the humblest of people. Maintaining calm, friendly ties with others was not his forte. Isolation from others was a leitmotif that ran through his entire life. With the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941, Japan entered an all-out war, and Amada left turbulent Tokyo and moved back to his parents' home in Aso. As the second son, he avoided all the problems involved in succeeding to his father's estate and was given a small house with a maid and lived a quiet life there, pretty much isolated from the war. For better or worse, he had a congenital lung defect, and thus there was no worry he would be drafted, though this could have been the excuse they used for the public, and his family may have worked behind the scenes to make sure he didn't have to be a soldier. He also avoided the severe food shortages and near starvation that plagued most Japanese citizens at the time. Living deep in the mountains of rural Japan, unless some major mistake was made, he could also be pretty certain that no U.S. planes would be dropping any bombs on them. So until the surrender in 1945, he lived, holed up alone, deep in the mountains of Aso. His ties with society were severed, and he devoted himself entirely to mastering the techniques of Japanese-style painting. He didn't display a single work during this time. For Tomohiko Amada, after being in the spotlight as a promising painter of Western art and then going to study in Vienna, it must have been a trying experience to maintain total silence for over 6 years, forgotten by the art world. But he was not the type to easily lose heart. When the long war was finally over, and as people struggled to recover from the chaos, a reborn Tomohiko Amada debuted again, this time as an up-and-coming painter in the Japanese style. One by one, he displayed the works he'd completed during the war. This was the period when most artists, having painted stirring propaganda pieces, were forced to take responsibility for their actions and, under the watchful eye of the occupation, were fairly compelled into retirement. Which is precisely why Tomohiko's works, revealing the possibility of a revolution in Japanese painting, garnered so much attention. The times, one could say, were his ally. There was little to say of his career after this time. Once an artist is successful, his life is often quite boring. Of course, there are some artists who, once they are successful, head straight toward a colorful downfall, but Tomohiko Amada wasn't one of them. He won countless awards over the years, though he turned down the Order of Cultural Merit Award from the government, claiming it would be distracting, and became very famous. Over the years, the price for his works rose, and most were displayed in public exhibitions. There was no end to the number of commissions, and he gained a high reputation abroad, too. Smooth sailing all around. The artist himself, though, avoided center stage and turned down any official positions. He also refused any invitations, domestic or international. Instead, he stayed holed up alone in the mountaintop house in Odawara, the house I was now living in, painting whatever he liked. Now he was 92, and in a nursing home in Izukogen, and no longer knew the difference between an opera and a frying pan. I shut the book of paintings and returned it to the library counter. When the weather was good, I liked to lie on a lounge chair out on the terrace after dinner and enjoy a glass of white wine. And as I gazed at the twinkling stars to the south, I would consider what lessons I might draw from Tomohiko Amada's life. Naturally, there should be a few lessons I should learn. The courage not to fear a change in one's lifestyle. The importance of having time on your side, and above all, discovering your own uniquely creative style and themes. Not an easy thing, of course, though if you make a living creating things, it's something you have to accomplish no matter what, if possible, before you turn 40. But what kind of experiences did Tomohiko Amada have in Vienna? What scenes did he witness? And most of all, what exactly made him decide to lay down his oil paintbrush forever? I pictured red and black Nazi swastika flags fluttering over a street in Vienna, a young Tomohiko Amada walking down that street. For some reason, the season is winter. He has on a thick coat, a scarf, and a cloth cap pulled down low. His face isn't visible. A streetcar rounds the corner and approaches in the newly falling sleet. As he walks, he exhales white breath into the air like the very embodiment of silence. The Viennese are in warm cafes, sipping coffee with a spot of rum. I tried visualizing his later paintings of Japanese scenes in the Asuka period overlapping with this old Viennese street scene, but my imagination was unequal to the task, and I couldn't discover any similarities between the two. My terrace faced the narrow valley to the west, and across the way was a range of mountains about the same height as mine, and on the slopes of those mountains were a number of houses with generous space separating them, surrounded by lush greenery. To the right, diagonally across from the house I was living in, was a particularly striking modern-style house. The mountaintop house, built of white concrete and plenty of bluish-tinted glass, was so elegant and luxurious, the word mansion seemed a better term. It was built in three levels that ran along the slope. Most likely some first-rate architect had designed it. There are lots of summer homes in this area, but someone seemed to live in this house all year long, with lights on behind the windows every night. Of course, it could be that the lights were on timers as a safety precaution, but I gathered otherwise, since the lights came on and turned off at different times, depending on the day. Sometimes all the lights were on at once and the windows were lit like brilliant window displays on a main street, while at other times the whole house sank back into darkness, the only light a faint glow from lanterns in the yard. Sometimes a person would appear on the deck that faced my direction, the one that resembled the top deck of an ocean liner. At twilight, I would often see the figure of whoever lived there. I couldn't tell if it was a man or a woman. The silhouette was small and usually backlit and in shadow, but from the outline of the silhouette and the movements, my guess was that it was a man. And this person was always alone. Perhaps he didn't have any family. What kind of person lived in a place like that? In spare moments, I tried to imagine. Did this person really live all by himself on this out-of-the-way mountaintop? What sort of work did he do? No doubt his life in that chic, glass-enclosed mansion was one of luxury and ease. He couldn't be commuting every day to Tokyo from such an inconvenient spot. He must be living a life free of worries. But viewed from his perspective, looking at me from his side of the valley, I might appear to also be living a life of ease and leisure. From a distance, most things look beautiful. That evening, the figure appeared again. Like me, he sat, barely moving, in a chair out on the deck, as if he too was gazing at the twinkling stars, mulling over something. Thinking, no doubt, about things for which there was no answer, no matter how hard you thought about them. At least, that's how he looked to me. Everybody has something they speculate and wonder about, no matter how blessed their circumstances. I raised my wine glass a couple of inches, a secret gesture of solidarity to this person across the valley. Naturally, at the time, I never imagined that this person would soon enter my life and change its direction entirely. Without him, none of the events that happened to me would have ever taken place. At the same time, if he hadn't been there, I might very well have lost my life in the darkness, with no one ever the wiser. Our lives really do seem strange and mysterious when you look back on them. Filled with unbelievably bizarre coincidences and unpredictable zigzagging developments, while they are unfolding, it's hard to see anything weird about them, no matter how closely you pay attention to your surroundings. In the midst of the everyday, these things may strike you as simply ordinary things, a matter of course. They might not be logical, but time has to pass before you can see if something is logical. Generally speaking, whether something is logical or isn't, what's meaningful about it are the effects. Effects are there for anyone to see and can have a real influence, but pinpointing the cause that produced the effect isn't easy. It's even harder to show people something concrete that caused it in a look, see kind of way. Of course, there is a cause somewhere. Can't be an effect without a cause. You can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. Like falling dominoes, one domino, cause, knocks over the adjacent domino, cause, which then knocks over the domino, cause, next to it. As this sequence continues on and on, you no longer know what was the original cause. Maybe it doesn't matter, or people don't care to know. And the story comes down to what happened was a lot of dominoes fell over. The story I'll be telling here may very well follow a similar route. In any case, the first things I want to describe, the first two dominoes I have to bring up, in other words, are the mysterious neighbor who lived on the mountaintop across the valley, and the painting titled Killing Commendatore. I'll start with the painting. Chapter 5. He has stopped breathing. His limbs are cold. The first thing I found odd after I moved into the house was the utter lack of any paintings. Not only were none hanging on the walls, but there wasn't a single painting of any kind even stuffed away in a shed or closet. No paintings by Tomohiko Amada, but none by any other artists either. Every wall was bare, with no traces even of nails that might have once been used to hang paintings. Artists almost always had at least some paintings around them, their own paintings or those by other artists. Before they knew what had hit them, they'd be surrounded by all kinds of paintings, like when you endlessly shovel the snow, but it keeps on piling up. Once, when I called Masahiko about something else, I happened to raise the topic.
How come there's not a painting of any kind in this house? Did somebody take them away, or there weren't any to begin with? My father didn't like keeping his own paintings around, Masahiko said. He'd call up his art dealers when he finished a work and leave it with them. If he wasn't happy with a painting, he burned it in the incinerator in the yard. So it's not so strange that there's not a single one of his paintings there.
He didn't own any paintings by other artists either?
He owned a handful, an old Matisse or Braque and the like. All of them small paintings he bought in Europe before the war. He got them from acquaintances, and they weren't so expensive at the time. Now, of course, they would bring a hefty price. When he went into the nursing home, I took all those paintings to an art dealer I know and let him handle them. Can't leave them sitting there in an empty house now, can I? I imagine they're in a special air-conditioned art storage warehouse. Apart from those, I've never seen any other artists' works in the house. To tell the truth, my father didn't much like other artists, and they didn't like him either. A lone wolf, you might call him, or if we're not being nice about it, a misfit.
Your father was in Vienna from 1936 to 1939, wasn't he?
Right, he was there for about 2 years. I don't know why he chose Vienna, since the artists he liked were mainly French.
And then he returned to Japan and suddenly switched to Japanese-style paintings, I said.
Why do you think he made such a monumental decision?
Did something unusual happen while he was abroad?
It's a mystery. My father never spoke much about his time in Vienna. Occasionally he'd talk about things nobody cared about, the Vienna Zoo, or food, or the opera house. But when it came to talking about himself, he was a man of few words, and I never dared to ask him. We mostly lived apart and rarely saw each other. He was less like a father to me than an uncle who came to visit every once in a while. When I got to junior high, he seemed even more annoying, and I avoided contact with him. When I went into the Art Institute, too, I never consulted him about it. It's not like our family was complicated, though it wasn't exactly a normal family either. You get the general idea?
I do.
Anyway, my father's memories of the past are all gone now, or have sunk away into deep mud. He won't answer you no matter what you ask. He doesn't even know who I am. Probably doesn't even know who he is. Sometimes I think I should have asked all kinds of things before he got this way. Well, it's too late now.
Masahiko was silent for a time, lost in thought.
Why do you want to know that? He finally asked. Did something spark an interest in him?
Not particularly, I said. It's just that living in this house, I sense something like your father's shadow lurking about. I also did a little research into his life at the library.
My father's shadow?
Like a reminder of his existence, maybe.
Don't you find that a little creepy?
Over the phone, I shook my head. No, not at all. It's just like the presence of Tomohiko Amada is still hovering over things. Like it's in the air. Masahiko was lost in thought again.
My father lived in that house for a long time, and he did a lot of work there, he said. So maybe his presence remains. Who knows? To tell the truth, that's why I don't want to go near the place.
I listened without comment.
Like I said before, he went on, to me, Tomohiko Amada was basically just a grouchy old man I knew, always holed up in his studio, painting, with a sour look on his face. He didn't talk much, so I had no idea what was on his mind. When we were under the same roof, my mom always told me, don't bother your father when he's working. I couldn't run around or yell or anything. The world saw him as a famous artist, but to a little kid, he was simply a pain. Plus, when I decided to go into art myself, having him as a father was a burden. Every time I introduced myself, people would ask if I was related to Tomohiko Amada. I even thought about changing my name. I realize now he wasn't such a bad person, really. I suppose he showed me affection in his own way, though he wasn't the type to show unconditional love toward a child. But that can't be helped. Painting was always his top priority,